and welcome to Live at the Boathouse on Boat Radio. I'm Mike McDowell. Each month we'll be discussing matters crucial to humanity generally, but the boating, sailing, swimming, diving and fishing communities particularly. Today our subject is marine conservation, with a look at one solution to the problem of particularly plastic garbage in our seas. Our venue is the Boathouse Restaurant and Bar on the waterfront here in Palma de Mallorca, capital of the Balearic Islands. Today I'll be joined by Pete Lucas, captain and co-owner of Bonny Lass, a classic Scottish former fishing trawler which now ploughs these waters as a charter vessel. Pete sees firsthand the damage done by synthetic materials carelessly cast aside. We'll be talking to him about that a little bit later. Also joining me today, Dr. Sergio Ruiz Halpin, resident marine scientist at the Seabin Project, an innovative solution to the problem of garbage in waters in and around particularly ports, harbours and marinas. The Seabin gathers that garbage into one container, passively, and without you or I having to lift a finger other than to empty the bin periodically. It's a clever idea that will hopefully appear in harbours worldwide very soon. We'll be chatting to Sergio a little later. But my first guest today is Brad Robertson, president of Association Ondine. Brad's an Australian scuba diver whose passion for marine ecosystems, particularly around these islands, led him to create what has become an environmental conservation organisation of world renown. Ondine is extremely active in organising educational events and hands-on beach and seafloor cleanups. And Brad believes that local people are key to the protection of all marine environments. So Brad, welcome to Boat Radio.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks for having me.
What brought you here, first of all, to the Balearic Islands?
My lovely wife, Bea, brought me to the Balearic Islands. We spent 5 years together in Australia. Bea's from Pamplona, and she wanted to come back to Spain. Pamplona, for a dive instructor with skipper's tickets and engineering tickets, was not exactly the place of huge offering as far as work's concerned. So we looked at a map and we saw a big island and it was called Mallorca. So that's exactly how we ended up here. Pure luck.
And what is so special then about the seas around these islands, about the marine life in these waters?
Wow, there's various aspects of the marine life that make it special. But considering I've had quite a few years diving experience up and down the east coast of Australia and seen some pretty amazing marine ecosystems. There are places in the Balearics where I still get in the water excited because of the array of marine life that is here. For the Mediterranean, most people have got a preconceived idea of the Mediterranean as being quite barren, overfished, polluted, and the Balearics has got a relatively good conservation status in comparison to the rest of the Med. So we're really in a little patch of paradise in amongst a very, very sick sea, being the Mediterranean.
How did Ondine come about? And I mean Association Ondine, the environmental side of things.
I met Gabriel Moret, our vice president. Gabriel's a shark and stingray specialist. Him and I share a passion for sharks. And when I first got to the island and met Biel, asked him about the shark population and where I'd find them. The answer wasn't exactly positive. But he did tell me about a population of stingrays. Being Elesmobranchs, they are a close cousin of the sharks, the stingrays, so that was the next best thing. We went and had a look at it. I went down there every day for a few months and hung out with definitely the most dense population of stingrays that I've seen anywhere in the world, which was absolutely mind-blowing at the time. I spoke to Biel and I said, listen, this is a really interesting subject. Why don't we put together a project to study the population, which we did. The budget, we were at that stage working with Jobbers Navigants to do a social and scientific project.
Who's that?
Jobbers Navigants are an organisation here in the Balearics. They've been around, Pete, I think they've been around for 20 years, 25 years? They've been around for a long, long time.
Yeah, there's a similar kind of setup to the Ocean Youth Club in in the United Kingdom, and it's for taking disadvantaged kids out, getting them on the water, getting them working together, and giving them a bit of an experience away from what they might be having at home.
So yeah, we thought we'd add that extra dimension into science research and get the kids involved. So then they could learn not only about the sailing and the marine environment above the waves, and join the two together. So we put it together, we got the budget together, and this was before the association was established. The budget for both organisations combined came to €36,000. I took a friend of mine diving. He asked me how the projects were going. I told him. He asked me how much I was looking for. I told him 36 grand, and he turned around and said, "I'll pay for that." So thank you very much, Stefan Hurst. That was the beginning of Association Ondine. So we had the project, we had the money, then we had to set up the association. Once that was done, he deposited the money in the account, and the rest is history. All good.
Right. And does Stefan Hurst still help fund?
He does indeed. He does indeed.
Right.
Stefan grew up on the island, and so he's got a very big soft spot for Majorca in particular.
And
he just likes what we do.
Okay, fair enough. Well, good for him. So, what's an MPA?
An MPA, a marine protected area. Marine protected area is a part of the sea that has, and it varies from MPA to MPA, what sort of regulations are involved with that area. But there are restrictions on fishing. Some of them, they've got restrictions on scuba diving. So any sort of human impact or human activity that has an impact on the marine environment are controlled in those areas. Up until about a week ago, we had 7 marine reserves locally controlled, and it was just last week that the Balearic government declared some of the waters surrounding Sar Dragonetta as a new MPA, which is fantastic news.
Right, that's Isla Dragonera you're talking about.
Correct.
So that is one of the smaller Balearic Islands. So why isn't it that the whole of the Balearic Islands are just one big marine protected area? Well, why have all these little bits? Why chip away at it in that way?
Great question, and my direct response to that would be, let's do it. Let's make one big MPA around the Balearics. But you have to take into consideration all the industries that work here in the Balearics, and having an idealistic boundary with full protection would be good on an environmental side of things, but on a business side of things, it would make life very, very difficult. The MPAs that were set up originally were set up to accommodate artisanal fisheries. They weren't set up for tourism. So the reason they've set these small ones up is to help boost the fish stocks so that the local fishermen can catch more fish.
You've been involved in creating this new marine protected area around Isla Dragonera, and it's taken you years to pull this off, right?
It has.
Yeah, why is it so complicated? Because it seems like a no-brainer. I know I'm being naive and childish and stupid, but you know, it seems ridiculous that an island like Isla Dragonera, nobody lives there. It's an amazing nature reserve. Why does this not include the sea all around it just automatically?
Well, for me, it's a no-brainer as well. But now Dragonera is partially protected. And I say partially because at the moment it's only internal waters. So it's the waters controlled by the Balearic Islands that are protected. That little patch of water, after about 5 to 10 years, we'll be generating a huge amount of money for the island through recreational diving. The ecosystems around Dragonetta have got the potential to be the best dive site in the Mediterranean, and now with this partial protection we're on track. So there are various reasons why things are complicated. The way that the waters are divided between the local government control and control by the Madrid government is one reason. But this is one step, Mike, in our plan for a network of MPAs all the way around the Balearic Islands. So what we're working on now is putting together a plan that will establish new MPAs around the Balearics. It's all based on science, so it's based on larval dispersal of fish, which means you'll have patches of protected areas around the Balearics. Those areas will rejuvenate, regenerate, they'll grow, and then we'll experience something called spillover. So the fish stocks will populate that area to a point of saturation. The species will then fall out of the boundaries, so to speak.
So you focus on fish nurseries, essentially.
Exactly, and then this will help with artisanal fisheries. The artisanal fisheries over the last 10-15 years has been on a decline, and we'd actually like to see that on an incline and increase. So by mixing in local fisheries and specific locations for MPAs, it's economically and environmentally, it's a huge win for the Balearic Islands.
So what are the big threats then to the environment, the marine environment around the Balearic Islands?
Overfishing, illegal fishing, the types of fishing that happen not just here but internationally, and the majority of...
You see, it's interesting you say that, because I thought you were going to start telling me about pollution and garbage in the sea and oil spills. Yeah, go for it.
I was getting to that. But all of these issues that we're discussing here in the Balearics are international issues, and they're faced by the majority of coastal areas that are populated with human beings. What really amazes me about the world of marine conservation is the lack of solidarity within the marine conservation world. Considering we're all fighting and working extremely hard for the same reasons, there should be, in my point of view, a lot more communication and a lot more sharing between organisations.
Yeah.
That's a big complication as well.
I'll tell you what, Pete Lucas is with us. Pete is the captain of Bonnie Lass, which is a classic Scottish fishing trawler from 1949. I know this because Boat Radio did a program all about Bonnie Lass a few months ago, and Pete took us on a guided tour of his amazing vessel. It's absolutely beautiful. So Pete, you're the captain and co-owner of Bonnie Lass, and you take people out on pleasure charters. So you do the psycho blocks, so the solo free climbing. You do snorkeling, diving, swimming, all sorts of stuff like that. So you're kind of at the sharp end, right? So you get to see all this pollution firsthand all the time. You go to coves and bays and beaches which are only accessible by boat. So what is it that you see that's ruining the environment here?
Lots of us are very interested in the environment, and we are able to see it at the weekend for a few hours when we're not in the office or we're not doing something else. It's when you spend the sheer amount of time on and in the water. So most of, for maybe 3 or 4 months of the year, I'm on the water from 8 o'clock in the morning till 11 o'clock at night most days. And from when I first make my journey from my house, which is 2 minutes from my dinghy, I walk down to to my little Zodiac and I climb in. And the first thing I notice when I climb in is a few plastic bags and a nice film of diesel or oil on the water in the harbour where I'm based, which is in Port Sawyer on the north coast of Mallorca. And then that clears as I make my way out to my boat, which is on a mooring in the middle of the bay. And I notice the water's quite churned up, and that's just the sheer number of boats anchoring and pulling their anchors up and dropping their anchors down as they're on their holidays, on their vacations. And then I pick up my clients and we go off and do, like many other people, just for a nice fun day on the water. So we'll go round to a cove. There's many little bays up along the north coast which are lovely to go to, and I've found over the time being here quite a lot of really cool little spots where you can snorkel through caves and pop up inside pools. And I find a lot of my time is spent is I'll nip in there first before the clients get there, before I take them inside, and I'll start picking up the plastic. I'll start removing the problem. I'll show the clients that that's what I'm taking away, because although I don't want to spoil the dream and I want them to come again year after year, it's important that they know that the plastic's there. But also, when you start swimming through it, you tend to disperse it. And when it's dispersed, it's much more difficult to collect. So every day we see this. And we also see especially where I'm based on the north coast of Mallorca, we see almost zero control. So the other week I was heading out to my boat and there must have been 200 or 300 litres of diesel had been pumped into the harbour. And the interesting part was that is a boat was just heading out to sea and I'd seen it from the balcony on my house because the alarm was going off on the boat and you could hear it on this perfectly still day, clear as a bell. The alarm was going off and I can only assume that that was the bilge alarm. So the boat must have accidentally had its diesel pumped into its bilges and then its automatic bilge pump then pumped that out. So I obviously left the harbour to try and find the boat's name and things like this, but he'd already long gone by the time I left. Now there is no there's no Coast Guard, there is no fisheries protection vessel, there's no Guardia Civil, there's nothing permanently based in Port Sawyer, and therefore there is zero control, so people can get away with these things, which is a terrible shame. You wouldn't get away with it in the middle of Palma, you shouldn't get away with it in a pretty picturesque fishing port.
Pete, thank you very much for that. We'll come back to you a little later on to speak a little bit more about that kind of stuff. And Sergio, Dr. Sergio, we'll come to you. You're waiting very patiently. We will come to you very soon. And Brad, I've got more points that I want to put to you. Dr. Michael Orr, who is a marine, he's actually a neuroscientist and marine biologist. And Boat Radio, we spoke to him a little while ago. He is at the expense of some obviously very rich guy traveling around the islands of Myanmar on board a luxurious schooner, classic schooner, with a crew, and he's doing a little bit of research as he goes, you know, and as I say, he's a neuroscientist. Apparently we know everything we know about the human brain from sea cucumbers and simple marine organisms, but he's a very interesting bloke. And one point he made to me was that we're never ever going to get people to keep the seas clean unless we make marine life more valuable alive than dead. It's as simple as that. And I wonder, and that sounds, you know, it sounds really cynical, doesn't it? It sounds like the heaviest dose of cynicism, and it's a miserable thing to say, but is he right? I mean, you know, instead of killing whales, you'd take people to see whales.
Of course,
and charge them money.
Yeah, definitely. I agree 100%. And they're doing this in various places around the world, particularly with shark diving operations. And they're putting a financial value on each shark per year when it's involved with shark tourism and shark diving, as opposed to its financial value if it was hooked up by a fishing boat and taken to the markets. And it's not really a comparison. The financial difference is obvious. So yeah, definitely. And I think with marine conservation as well, there needs to be a financial side to it for things to work. And in fact, we're discussing within Association Ondine, this is something I'd like to speak to Sergio and the Seabin boys about as well, is about innovations, because I, after being exposed to the world of corporate conservation over the last 2.5 years, I really think that that there could be a lot more done with the finances that are put into these organisations. So the input to output ratio is questionable in big NGOs. But what I do like is the concept of a business that is beneficial for the environment. Now, having a business that's beneficial for the environment, if we had enough businesses that were beneficial for the environment, we wouldn't need NGOs because the businesses would be looking after the environment. And this is a concept that I think we'll see more and more of over the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years. When my kids are 20 years old, I think big NGOs will be seeing the back end of them. And we'll be seeing all these innovations coming and these new businesses and these new technologies that are actually beneficial for the environment, and not just the marine environment but the terrestrial environment as well.
Basically making a clean sea worth money.
Exactly. If you put a monetary value to any of this, people will be involved. And you look at the history of the human race over the last 50 years, 60 years, it's all been about money. It's chasing money, making money. So if we can chase money and make money, but make money by protecting and God forsake, improving the marine environment, then all of a sudden you're mixing capitalism with environmentalism, and you've created something. What would you call that, Sergio? Dr. Sergio?
Emerging property?
Yeah, exactly.
Something like
but
that.
But it's something, and this is why I really take my hat off to the Seabeam guys.
I'll make a little comment there. When you're speaking about making marine life more valuable alive than dead, value doesn't necessarily always equate to money. Unfortunately, in the world we're living in, we need to speak that language, right? So we need to put a dollar stamp on the marine life. And one of the solutions is not relying on NGOs or big NGOs, because pulling in funding is not always easy. So like Brad is saying, corporate responsibility or social responsibility or environmental responsibility, companies that actually have the core of their activity actually improves the environment are part of the solution. And on top of that, those companies within their DNA, they want to help in the conservation efforts. So of course they're going to derive some of those funds to innovate and create further added value to the marine conservation or terrestrial conservation or planet conservation side of things.
Sure, Sergio, thank you very much for that. I want to find out all about you, but we're going to take a little break now. You're listening to Live at the Boathouse on Boat Radio, coming to you from the waterfront in magnificent Palma de Mallorca, the fabulous capital of the Balearic Islands. We're talking marine conservation, and so after the break, I will come to Dr. Sergio Ruiz Halpin, who you heard just there, and find out why he's here and what exactly is the Seabeam. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Our aim at Street Invest is to put a trustworthy adult into the lives of street children so that they can support them in creating the most positive paths for their lives in the future. We work around the world, working on the street with the children where they are. For such a large group of children, the amount of funding available is tiny. Really, the funding that keeps organisations like Street Invest going comes from individual donors. Street children are the most abused, neglected, violated children, yet they're also the most resourceful, responsive, and resilient children that we could have the honour of working with.
For more information or to make a donation, visit streetinvest.org.
This is Live at the Boathouse on Boat Radio. I'm Mike McDowell. We are in a terrific location, the Boathouse Restaurant on the waterfront in Palma de Mallorca. Today we are talking about marine conservation, both generally and with specific reference to the Balearic Islands, Mallorca, Menorca, Ibiza, Formentera, Cabrera, Dragonera, and the many other smaller islands that make up this spectacular archipelago. And it's not just spectacular on the surface, it's an amazing underwater environment too. So we heard just before the break from Dr. Sergio Ruiz Halpern, who, and don't let his absolutely perfect English fool you, he's neither British nor American. You are in fact Mallorquin, right?
No, I'm actually from Madrid, okay. One of the most landlocked capitals of Europe.
Okay, but presume you craved the sea. How did you end up a marine biologist?
How do I end up a marine biologist? I guess documentaries play a big part in it. But after I finished my bachelor's degree in Madrid, and I became a diving instructor as well myself, I realized I wanted to pursue something else. I wanted to learn more about the environment, not just be in it and dive in it and learn other people how to enjoy it. So I went on and I did my master's degree in the United States. So I spent 4 years in Miami diving all around the Florida Keys, Florida Bay, researching seagrass environments and coral reefs. Then I came back to Spain and I started my PhD here in Mallorca, and then that's when I fell in love with the Balearic Islands. I spent 5 years doing my PhD, and after my PhD it was time to keep on doing research, and Australia was the place. So I spent another 3.5 years in the eastern seaboard of Australia doing climate change related research, so greenhouse gas fluxes and carbon dynamics. And then it was time to come back to Spain. I wanted to establish myself in Mallorca, so I looked for ways to doing it, and out of serendipity I came to visit my friends, and out in the street I met Pete and Andrew, who are the inventors of the Seabin, and we hit it off. They needed a marine scientist to help them in their endeavors, and I was up for the challenge, and that's how it all started.
Wait a minute, you bumped into them in the street?
Literally, through a close friend of ours. Well, when I was in Australia, I had a roommate that was from Mallorca, but that I hadn't met before. So I met her in Australia, and I came back, and I was with her going surfing, and she's friends with Pete, and that's how we met.
This raises lots of questions about things like, what the hell is carbon dynamics? But we'll get onto that another day.
Well,
what I want to ask you now is, what the hell is the Seabin?
The Seabin is a very clever contraption to clean the surface of the water of any floating trash. It doesn't necessarily have to be plastic. As long as it's floating on the water, the Seabin is able to capture it. And I think that the best way to picture it is if you take the skimmer of a swimming pool at the very end of it. There is a pump that makes the water circulate, and there's a basket at the very end of it. Take that and encase it into a rubbish bin and put it in the water and activate it with a pump, and that's essentially what it is.
Because it looks like a rubbish bin, a garbage bin, floating just below the surface. So just the rim of it shows above the surface, right?
Well, it's called Seabin for a simple reason. It's a rubbish bin that you put in the water, literally.
But how does it suck the rubbish in?
So you have a water pump. You need to make the water flow. So there is a water pump that makes the water circulate through the rubbish bin. And inside the rubbish bin, there's a catch bag with little holes in it. The hole has a size of 2 millimeters, so we can actually capture some fraction of the microplastics, and we can maybe get into it a bit deeper later on. But essentially, it has a catchback that allows the water to move freely through, activated by the water pump, and that takes up all of the floating rubbish that you get in marinas and harbors.
Okay, but it's powered then?
Yes, it is powered with a water pump.
Solar powered?
We can power it solar, but we're actually doing the research right now. It will depend on what kind of environments we're in. So in the Balearic Islands, it's an ideal candidate to power it solar, maybe especially more in the summer. But maybe some other areas of the world where they don't receive enough sunlight, you need to find alternative renewable energies, wind or wave energy. I mean, we can use renewable, but right now what we want to have is a Seabin that is operational, that's in the water. So if we're plugging it to shore power, we're happy for now.
Once you get it in the water, though, and once you've got it plugged in or solar powered, it's passive. You just leave it there.
You leave it
there.
It
floats with just this ring showing above the surface, and it just gathers all the crisp packets and fag butts and whatever the hell else people have chucked into the water. And
well,
does it draw in chemicals and oil and the slicks you see on the surface?
You can. There's if you put some absorbent pads or fuel water separators, we can actually catch detergents, diesel oil.
How big an area will one Seabin cover? Like if you...
The tests that we've done have captured stuff from around 300 meters away. But that's going to depend a lot on the environmental conditions, on the geography of the port and the marina. So we need to work with nature rather than against it. Marinas and the places where the Seabins are going to be installed, there's probably a lot of prior knowledge or where the trash accumulates, whether it's from the currents and from predominant winds, from the wake from the boats.
Okay.
So that's the ideal locations for the Seabins.
Yeah.
And you also have the Yetis and the pontoons, that have a certain size, so it's going to effectively
but if
cover
it's
those
joined
areas.
From 200 or 300 meters away, then one or two sea bins will clean the surface of a sort of fairly substantial marina.
Yes, it all depends on the amount of litter that that marina is getting, how often the marina workers need to go there and empty it, and it also depends on as I was saying, on how the port is configured. So you might need to have some locations, regardless of the distance, that are not accessible to the power of the draw of the sea bin, and you need to put an extra one. So depending on the size of the marina, you're going to need one, two, up to five or six or ten.
Wow, ten. Mm. Well, that brings us to a problem, because they're not free. How much are
they? Not, but we don't have a price yet. We're in the middle of testing the prototype that will go into production, and there's a few features that we're still tweaking, and we want to be as responsible as possible. So the production is not going to be the cheapest in the world, but at the same time, we're going to have the less amount of material necessary and the best plastic that will be recyclable, or even use recycled plastic already to produce them. And materials that will be, we're trying to design a sea bin that we can actually completely disassemble and put back into circulation once we have a new model or we have improvements of the sea bin, so that we're actually not creating any waste whatsoever.
But wouldn't it be amazing if you could make the sea bins out of the crap that you're picking off the surface of the water?
That is our plan. It's the concept of circular economy, how we can actually change the word residue for the word resource. Right now, the ocean is full of plastic. And if we're able, as we were discussing before, assign a value to the plastic that's there, might be worth recovering it to produce. We don't actually need to produce any more plastic from fossil fuels. We can actually reuse the plastic that's already there. We just need to find efficient ways to recover it.
Right. Okay. So the plan in the first instance, presumably, is for upmarket yacht clubs, kind of the sort of fancy pants places that Pete Lucas hangs out, to buy these very expensive items to make their waters super sparkling clean in order to draw in more of the Kim Kardashians, people like that?
Yes and no. They're not going to be that expensive. I believe that a lot of marinas are going to be able to afford them. And of course, we'll have tiers of marinas that will use these. We have some marinas that will be more actively engaged with us through a pilot program, and they will help us collect information on the plastics that we're gathering and help us teach the kids the problems of plastic. Because one of the big milestones, or one of the big objectives, the goals that Seabin has, is not to just put a rubbish bin in the water and make money and make the marina feel good about itself. We actually want to make a change, and that it's only going to happen through education. So the money that we're going to be getting from the sea bins, we're going to use that to involve school kids or schools to come and work with the sea bins and learn about the issue of plastics in the oceans. So some of the marinas will help us actively through this pilot program that we have. That's going to have an extra cost. But then we're designing educational and scientific materials that any marina that has sea bins can actually use and help, not only on the active collection of the rubbish, but also giving out information and raising even more awareness on this issue of plastics in the ocean.
Of course, a lot of marinas are owned and leased out by local authorities. So it could become part of a local authority's rubbish collection and recycling program, right?
When they're leased out, it's the marina itself that makes the decision. They have their they manage their own budget and they do whatever they want. If it's loaned by the local authorities, it's a bit more complicated, but it's not impossible, and we'll certainly work with that as well. Ideally, you want to have influence on policymaking and legislation.
Yeah.
So if the CBINs work like they're intended to, we are actually in conversations with Horizon 2020 European projects to try and have some sort of standard way of tackling the issue of marine debris in the oceans.
I want to go back to this kind of big picture stuff and come back to you, Pete, because I know you think about this a great deal. There are lots of huge kind of scary statistics about the destruction of marine environments, and I remember seeing these data visualization experts who do stuff for Huffington Post, Joe Chernoff and Robin Richards. They came up with that amazing infographic which shows that humans kill 11,000 sharks per hour worldwide, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. We kill 11,000 sharks per hour, and that equates to about 100 million a year. Do you think we're in danger, when you speak to your clients and whoever else, that we're in danger of overloading people with this and all these huge kind of measurements of destruction? Because when I hear 11,000 an hour, I think to myself, God almighty, what can I do about that? There's nothing I can do about that. That's too enormous. So are sometimes these kind of stats dangerous to the actual causes that they're supposedly created to promote?
I think it's an interesting idea, and it's certainly it can be a problem. When I've got guests on the boat and I'm talking to them about some of the projects we're involved with and what we do and the kind of the ethos of why we're on the water, you can see people glaze over a little bit. So I think it's really key when you're trying to put the message across is to put the right message across, and enough to gain interest but not to make people feel that in actual fact it's finished, there's no point trying, it's already happened. And one of the probably the best project that I talk about on the boat, the most positive thing that really has a effect with the clients, is the Stingray survey project that we've been involved with Brad, because that is a massive number of stingrays that were found to be frequenting one particular area to reproduce every year. Now, they weren't destroyed. They were there. It was a healthy population. And the work and the efforts that were put in by everybody that was involved with the project enabled that population to be protected. So that is a positive story, and I find that most of the people I have on the boat, and we have a publication of a book that we keep on board, and it shows pictures of people having nice holidays, and it also has pictures of our work with Ondine and Brad with the Stingray survey, and that is probably the most hard-hitting point, and it makes people interested and it makes them smile. Because we all need light at the end of the tunnel, and picking up bits of plastic does help, and we do that every day, and I do that with my clients, but we do need a good story. And you're right, I think at some point there is the numbers can squash your enthusiasm to help.
So Brad, you work on this all the time. How do you go about coordinating all the many competing interests? So when you're doing something like the MPA proposal for Isla Dragonera that we talked about earlier on, there's the fishing industries, oil and gas companies, shipping lines, tourist authorities, recreational boaters, scuba divers, swimmers. How do you coordinate all of them? Because they're all pulling in different directions.
It's a big job. And I mean, the Isla Dragonera proposal was, in the whole scheme of things, dare I say it, a relatively easy proposal to put together, because it was one little patch of water in one area, and it was actually the Ayuntamiento, the local council in Port Andrés, that asked for or called for Dragonetta to be protected from sea level down.
In that case, because they see the value in it.
Exactly.
Andrach is all about tourism, right?
Correct. And whoever's owning the dive centres in, like I said before, the dive centres in Port Andrach, so over the next few years will start to see quite an increase in their numbers of divers coming through once people know that that Dragonetta is protected. But the stakeholders, Mike, that's a big job. The Hotel Association here in the Balearic Islands is a really powerful organisation, and an organisation that we need to sit down with and discuss what their requirements are. The diving industry, there's over 30 dive centres in Mallorca alone, so we need to take their considerations in. Like you said, all the fishermen as well. So it's an interesting dynamics, but the common denominator is we all need to make money. And if we look at that common denominator and we say, okay, well, if we all need to make money in our own little industries, then the importance of having these marine protected areas is obvious, and as we said before, a no-brainer. It's just about how we go about involving the stakeholders that are there. There's a big issue in the Balearics at the moment with the posidonia, with the seagrass, with anchoring. There was a matriculation tax that was manipulated in such a way that it's now basically opened the doors to yacht charters from different parts of the world coming into the Balearic Islands, where before there was a tax that sort of stopped people coming in because it was so high. So even this summer, I noticed a lot more big yachts anchored up in the Bay of Palma. I saw a lot more social media tension on Twitter, on Facebook, from local people, from yachts, from both sides. I go on to the yachts, under the super yachts here in the Balearics as a private guide, private instructor. And when I go up to the bridge and speak to the captain, the first thing he says to me is, where can I anchor? I don't know where to anchor. Everybody's talking about the Posidonia. What can I do? So there's a massive need, there's a huge demand for information about where people can do the right things, because a lot of these people want to do the right things. So this is another area where Association Ondine we're in a really unique position. We've got an awesome, fantastic relationship with the local government. We've got a really, really good relationship with the local yachting industry. So we're in a nice position where we can try and actually do something productive for both sides. But it's not an easy thing to do, Mike, to answer your question simply. Stakeholders and everybody's vested interest, it's a challenge.
Yeah, sure. Pete, when you're out and about on your travels with clients, what is the most... Is it fag butts? Is it cigarette lighters? Is it crisp packets? What's the most conspicuous, the most common form of environmental pollution that you see?
When you're looking in the water and you see plastic groups up, it gets washed, it gets driven by the currents, and it gets driven by the wind, and it tends to collect. So when you start going through a collection of plastic as you're loading it into your dinghy while your clients are up in the restaurant having lunch, it's such a myriad of plastics, and it's also a myriad of ages, because the plastic, it degrades and it gets smaller and smaller, and you know that you're missing a massive percentage of what is in the water where you're trying to clean. But what amazes me is it's not what we throw out today that's the problem. It's also what we threw out 30 years ago. It's still floating around and breaking down.
That is so depressing. You and I were on a beach clean earlier this year at Ses Cambres, which is a... To explain to anyone who doesn't know Mallorca and doesn't know the north coast of Mallorca, Ses Cambres is a couple of little coves, only accessible by boat, on the north coast of the island. We collected something like 80 kilos of mostly polystyrene, as I recall, but also car batteries and all sorts of bits of packaging from around TVs and other sort of consumer electronics and stuff. That was a few months ago. We left it pretty clean. As I recall, I was on my hands and knees picking up little bits of polystyrene for a couple of hours. And we'd recorded it all for a podcast that anybody who's interested can listen on Boat Radio. You can find it, The Beach Clean. But how long did it take to get dirty again?
Well, that's a good question. in my business, the nice thing is that, I mean, we have to, Brad was talking about money, we have to make money, we have to maintain the boat, keep it safe for the customers on board, my kids have to go to school, we have to eat. So for the height of the summer, we focus very much on our charter business. And then towards the end of the year and in the beginning of the year, we're able to do these projects. So the beach clean, for instance, was one which was, apart from anything else, it was a good fun day, but also a very successful day with the 80 kilos of plastic. But I'm hoping that we'll be doing another radio program within the next 4 weeks, because I want to go back and visit all of the places that I've cleaned this year, and then we will have an idea in a number of months, because we knew when we were on those beaches before, and we'll have an idea how many kilos of plastic collect within a number of given months.
Thanks, Pete. There's a question I'd like to put to all of you, actually, because you're all very well-travelled individuals. Sergio, I'll come to you first. Is there anywhere that you've been on your travels, any stretch of coastline or an island or somewhere in the world that's doing it right, that you think we could all learn from? You know, like when you talk about education and everybody says, Finland. Look at what Finland's doing. Is there a Finland of the marine environment?
That's a very, very good question. The short answer is no. Long answer is it's a learning process. I mean, we can all put our hands up in arms and say, like, oh, we're killing the environment, we're doing this, we're doing that. But in a lot of instances, collectively as humanity, we just didn't know. Now we do. So what happened 50 years ago was when plastic started becoming, in the instance of plastic, for example, when it became of general use, we just didn't know it was going to create this problem. Now we know there is a big problem. And now the issue is that some of us are trying to do our best. We're gathered here in this table, but a lot of people are not. And that's the crucial point. That's the tipping point. That's what we need to do. So no one's doing perfectly. Some places are doing it better than others in some areas. Some places are doing it better than others in other areas. The lesson here is try to go place by place and what is it that they did right there and that we can implement in our local place, and what are we doing right that we can tell others in their own place, and the solutions are not unique.
So Brad, briefly the same question to you: who's doing it the best, the Maldives, Tuvalu?
In my experience, nowhere in the world that's doing it perfectly. It comes down to a change in the way that our society is structured and the way that we think is normal. So, you know, we're talking about plastic, and plastic's by far, you can talk about all these other pollutants, but it's as far as Association Ondine's concerned, it's the number one subject that we're working on, is to change the way that you're living your life on a daily basis, and that we're living our lives on a daily basis. And it's really tough. My wife Bear and I, we've attempted to live completely single-use plastic-free. Now you think about every item that's in your household, in your refrigerator, in your freezer, in your bathroom, in your shed, everywhere.
It's plastic. Not possible to do it, right?
But it takes a lot of energy.
It does. If you had all day to yourself to focus on living a waste-free and a single-use plastic-free life, yes, you could achieve that. When we first started to be aware of this and try and take it back to our home, because we're preaching it, I'm running the association, we're doing the beach cleans, we've got our schools project as well, which we run, teaching the school kids about the plastic pollution. We're obliged to do something at home, we had to. But for us, with a 3-year-old and a 16-month-old child, we need to go to 5 different places to get all of our shopping, which takes 5 times as long. So the kids are going in and out of the car 5 times more than what they would if you went to one spot.
And you're in the car, so you're using petrol.
Exactly. So it's a challenge, but there's, I mean, this is where we go back to talk about business innovation and different products. I was looking at, there was somebody sent me an awesome link the other day. It was a cloth and beeswax sandwich wrap. So to replace your cling wrap, and it was reusable, and it was made of some type of biodegradable material, maybe hemp, covered in beeswax, and you wrap your sandwiches in it.
Boat Radio's Sarah O'Kelly, interviewed last week or the week before, and the program's going to be available next week, the Saltwater Brewery in Florida.
Uh-huh.
And the Saltwater Brewery in Florida makes their yolks for their six packs out of barley.
Yeah.
And instead of strangling sea creatures, it's actually food for sea creatures. So they're feeding them an extract of barley. And that's really clever. But it's more expensive. And that's the problem, isn't it? And this is a question, actually, for another program. The problem is that we've all got used to stuff being cheap and quick. And if you want to be environmentally friendly, no single-use plastic, it's more expensive and it's slower, it all takes longer, and it ends up with the consumer, the little people, paying out more of their hard-earned money and giving up more of their time, right? But this, I mean, listen, this, that's a question for another day. Brad Robertson, Sergio Ruiz Halpern and Pete Lucas, thank you very much indeed for speaking to Boat Radio today. I am extremely grateful. It was a great show. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks, boys.
Cheers. And we'll see you again soon, I'm sure.
Absolutely. This has been Live at the Boathouse on Boat Radio. We'll be talking more about the marine environment and questions important to absolutely everybody on the planet again soon on Boat Radio. Thank you for listening.
Our aim at Street Invest is to put a trustworthy adult into the lives of street children so that they can support them in creating the most positive paths for their lives in the future. We work around the world, working on the street with the children where they are. For such a large group of children, the amount of funding available is tiny. Really, the funding that keeps organisations like Street Invest going comes from individual donors. Street children are the most abused, neglected, violated children, yet they are also the most resourceful, responsive and resilient children that we could have the honour of working with.
For more information or to make a donation, visit streetinvest.org.